Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture and urban design. Hello, we kick off our 2024 podcast series with a focus on the environment and how members of our community are actively working to protect and restore our precious landscape. Alexandra Steed, who is a landscape architect and founder and director of Alexandra Steed Urban, has written a powerful book called Portrait to Landscape, a Landscape Strategy to Reframe Our Future. A practical book providing strategies for policymakers, activists, and individuals to protect and restore landscapes. The book has been described as a call to arms for all landscape professional and environmental professionals. Alexandra is also an advisor for the government's Office for Place and a member of the Design Council. Hello, Alexandra. You're very busy.
Hello, Catherine. Hi. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for coming in. I wondered if you could start off by telling us a bit about yourself and your journey to landscape.
Right. Well, I suppose it started very young. I always loved nature. And I think I was very privileged to grow up in Vancouver, Canada, where we were completely surrounded by nature. And I had parents that really sort of instilled that love in me from an early age. And I was also always a great lover of art. Uh-huh. So when I graduated from secondary school, I went to study art. So I did that for 4 years and realized in that time that I actually wanted to do something I think that was a little bit more practical.
Right.
And something where I felt that I was really serving people and the population. So I had thought about going into architecture, but then I came across an old friend that I met again at the university who I'd not seen for years. And he described to me that he was in landscape architecture. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, I'd never heard of landscape architecture. But when he described it to me, I just thought, wow, this is perfect. You know, it's a way that I can express myself creatively and use natural materials and work with the beauty of nature. But to have the opportunity to actually sort of sculpt the land and work with the medium of landscape itself just was exhilarating to me. So I've never turned back.
Wow.
I went to landscape architecture school and carried on.
Amazing. And through your journey through as a landscape architect and the work that you've done, what moved you to write this book?
Yes, well, I've been thinking about it for a number of years. And, yeah. You know, as our environmental challenges continue to grow and the urgency continues to grow around climate change, around population expansion, ecological decline, you know, all of these things that are happening in the world around us more and more dramatically and kind of and it's accelerating.
Yeah.
You know, and the scientific community unequivocally states that it is an emergency situation. And so I just felt, well, if I'm going to do something about it, I sort of have to do it now. You know, the time is
now.
Can't
wait until your retirement.
Exactly.
Or, right. It's not a project to
yes,
wait for.
That's right. You know, and so the UN has said this is the decade of action. And we're well into that decade now. And so I did feel an urgency to share with people that actually it is because of a broken relationship with nature yeah. that we've gotten ourselves into this predicament. And so in the landscape is where this broken relationship is most evident.
Yeah.
But it's also where we can bring about healing. And so I just wanted to share that with people about how we can then, you know, start to change our outlook, change our worldview in a way that will allow healing to occur yeah. on the earth. You know, there's hope. There is a way
and
out.
I think it is, you have a hopeful outlook. And I really, really love the description you have of changing from self-portrait and looking at a wide-angled lens of the landscape. And it's a very simple visual, but it describes how we've been looking for the last sort of few centuries, you know, how we've been looking for a long time at ourselves
yeah,
and how we flip it to the outside looking.
I don't really know how I came up with that phrase originally, But there's something about it that's really helped me conceptualize this whole idea about changing our perspective, right, about changing our worldview. And I mentioned it to a couple of other people, and suddenly they got it too. So I thought, well, let's use that as the title of the book and use it as a concept that I can then sort of frame everything throughout this book with. And for me, it's sort of a two-dimensional reframing. One dimension is, you know, in a simple portrait orientation to a landscape, yeah, orientation that opens it up, that widens up the field. But then there's also a different dimension that turns the gaze from yourself outwards. Yeah. So from inwards to outwards. And I think those two things really sort of encapsulate the kind of shift, yeah, that we all need to undergo. Some people are much further along that path than others. I would say our governments tend to fall behind us, right, as individuals. But yes, I think it would help everyone.
You make a really great, you also talk about in the book that you know, we've as a society, we're shifting from an individual to a community focus, but how the landscape actually should be, not actually, but the landscape should be part of that community. It shouldn't be a human community. Mm. So it's kind of self-portrait or individual, communal, communally embracing nature, not just man or humankind.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I would like to read a quote.
Yes,
that's
please.
Okay. So
yes,
there's, you know, aside from this phrase, a portrait to landscape, it was actually a quote from Einstein that I found in a book of one of his letters a few years ago. I don't even remember, again, how I happened to read that book, but it was sitting on my shelf.
Yeah.
And so one day I just started looking through it, and I came across this quote that I'll read now. It says, "A human being is part of a whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty."
Mm.
And so, you know, that quote for me was game changing.
Right.
And
Had you started writing the book at that point, or were you at the beginning?
I hadn't really formally started writing, yeah, the book. I was just thinking about, yeah, all the ideas, and then I came across this quote, and it just so beautifully wrapped up everything that I'd been thinking about.
Right.
And, you know, the way he just so succinctly states that the problem is a delusion of separateness, that, yeah, we're not separate, and that it's incarcerated us. You know, we're imprisoned in this delusion.
Yeah.
And our task, he sets out, our task must be to free ourselves from this and embrace all of nature.
Right.
And if we can do so, you know, if we can learn to collaborate with nature and see ourselves within that wider community, as you were saying.
Yes.
Then suddenly all of these wonderful opportunities and answers to all of our problems become very clear.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quite astounding, actually, how just a change in perspective like that can yeah, open up a new world.
But it's an important way of framing it, I think, for people. I mean, a lot of our listeners will feel that, but I think what your, you know, portrait to landscape, but also self-portrait to landscape, but also Einstein's quote helps, like, understanding this kind of nature's actually part of us, not something we can do whatever we want with, because it will, yes, it will fight back.
Well, exactly. And when we take care of nature, yeah, we take care of ourselves,
yeah,
because we are part of nature. And
yeah,
another person who I love to read is Aldo Leopold.
Yep.
So he's one of the earliest conservationists from America in the 20th century. And he wrote something called The Land Ethic that I think quite a few people are familiar with, but probably not enough people.
Right.
And it's a really wonderful text that looks at how, you know, we have ethics that help us sort of relate to each other, that relate within a community, that guide our sort of way of being within a community of people.
Mm.
But there is nothing that sets sort of a moral compass for people to be living in the wider community of nature. And so he set out this land ethic that would act as sort of a way to guide us and to protect us actually from ourselves. And the way that we interact with all of nature.
So it's another example of nature being part of our community, not just people.
Yes, yeah. That we're all residents on this planet, not just human. And, you know, the land, our soils, the air we breathe, the water we drink, that's what sustains us.
If we don't look after it, it makes us sick.
Exactly. So if we take care of our soils and are able to grow healthy food and drink fresh water and breathe fresh air, then of course we can only benefit. There's no negative consequences to that.
Yes. That leads us on. So talking about the landscape, the ethics of landscape, it actually leads us on to... Really, I'd like to summarize the four parts of the book, but there's one part that we're going to look at in detail. Mm-hmm. The landscape ethics, actually taking landscape into account with any development or planning is actually a big part of your book. So could you just go through the sort of the four key parts? And then I thought we could spend some time focusing on the fourth part, where we go into a bit more detail about some of the practical policies and strategies that you've suggested.
Sure. Yes. Yeah, so when I went to write the book, I had no experience writing a book, and actually, I found it.
There's a whole other podcast on that.
Definitely. Yeah, it's quite a task for somebody that's not done it before. And so I think just as a way to simplify the process for myself, I thought, well, what do I know how to write? And I know how to write a landscape strategy. Right. That's what I've been doing for the last 20 years. So I thought, okay, well, I'll write the book as if it were a landscape strategy, but this time at a global scale. So that's how I approached it. I set out a vision first.
Yep.
Then I moved into the analysis. Then I moved to the design principles. And then the final section is called key moves, which sets out, you know, your design actions. So I started with vision, and that was very much kind of based around that quote of Einstein that I read. So I really sort of laid out a paradigm shift that needs to kind of guide all of our future thinking. So looking at how we are currently viewing ourselves as separate from nature, about how to free ourselves from this imprisonment, we need to then see ourselves within the wider community of life, and how then moving forward, we need to be embracing all of nature. So that sort of then is a lens, and this vision of a new world that guides the rest of the book and sort of acts as the foundation for everything else that's said and spoken about in the book. So that sets the vision for a portrait to landscape paradigm shift. And then the second section, which is really sort of an analysis and assessment of where we currently are, I've called the big picture.
It's like a current state.
So that lays out the existing conditions, as we'd say in the landscape world. It looks at a lot of the challenges we're facing. So as we've talked about already, you know, with ecological decline, with climate change and global warming, with huge population expansion, all of the weather events, storm events, all the terrible things that are happening around the world. It looks at all of those things, how we got to that point, and then starts to look at how we can then convert those challenges into our greatest opportunities. And so that's exactly what we do as landscape designers. You know, we start to look at the constraints of a site, the challenges that are faced. But then as designers, as creative people, then we're always looking at, but that could be an opportunity, you know. So that's what the book is trying to emphasize, that we're not stuck there. There is always a way out, and there's always a way to transform our current situation.
And before we go on to the third part, what I like about the book is obviously, as you say, it's written, you know how to write a landscape strategy, so it will be familiar with a lot of landscape architects and designers, but it's also written from a very human, it's accessible to everyone, which I think was important to you, it sounds, in terms of not just focusing on a group who feel the same way as you, but actually getting the story out much wider.
That's right. Yeah, I wanted everybody to understand the importance of landscape because mostly because there is so much hope there. And it's just such a wonderful, rich medium. You know, this the foundation of life itself. And so I wanted to spread the word. I think landscape architecture can be quite a confined community. And so it doesn't really get spoken about in the press or in the media, and yet there's so much possibility there. So that was, yes, you're exactly right. That was my intention, to make it accessible to everybody.
So defining the landscape was the sort of the third part.
That's right. Yeah. So then the third piece looks at kind of design principles, which is also kind of the step I would typically take in a landscape strategy. So that was looking at how important our interaction with the land is, especially looking at soils, air, and water as the three major elements. And if we can get those things right, if we can get our relationship with those three elements right, everything else sort of falls into place, including all of the flora and fauna on the planet, and our own health and well-being. So yes, and then it looks at the biosphere and its remarkable capacity for self-renewal and regeneration when only we allow it to. You know, at the moment, we're just completely saturating the planet with
suffocating
toxins
it.
And contaminants and pollution. And it's just, it's oversaturated now and we're not stopping. So the biosphere doesn't have a chance to regenerate. It doesn't have
a chance to recharge.
Which
it could do if it was. And what was the fourth area? So that's the bit that we're moving on to now.
Yes. So that I've called key moves. So these are the actions, then. It's kind of bridging the philosophical and conceptual ideas held within the earlier chapters of the book to practical strategies. Because I think that's often what's missing.
There's a lot of theory and strategy, but not this is what we should be doing or this is what we can do now.
Exactly. Yeah. It's thinking, okay, so what are some of the ways that we can actually bring about change in a very practical and a very clear way for people to understand? So that's what I try to do in the final section of the book, is outline sort of from top down to ground up approaches about some of these actions that must be taken if we're really to change the world.
So the first, you discuss the role of government and investment and the responsibility of the state, really to use public money wisely, but also acquire money from large corporations wisely as well. So true investment in the land, what does that mean?
Right. Well, yes. So I've included five sort of major moves. One is true investment, as you just mentioned. Another is called humble governance. Mm. And then I sort of then step down to landscape-led developments. Mm-hmm. Then I move to green educations and skills. And then I look at what the individuals can do. But yes, starting with true investment, that is really something that needs to happen at a government scale and among the largest landowners on the planet. There are certain individuals that have an incredible amount of power, that have massive land holdings, far, far more than, you know, the rest of the world's population together. So so these people, these individuals and governments and organizations have a huge responsibility then to be taking care of their land. But at the moment, I would say, you know, the majority of landowners are all in it for themselves. It's about, you know, what kind of profit can they be making? What can they extract from the land? How can they exploit it for financial benefit?
They own that resource in their minds,
Exactly. And really what we need to be looking at is how can we invest back into land? How can we make the land healthier? How can we make it sort of more productive and vital for the community of life, as we were talking about, for the ecosystems that exist, for the wildlife that's there? So all of these things, you know, we need to be investing back. At the moment, it's all about withdrawing and nothing going back into the land. So, I mean, of course, there are wonderful things happening, but not nearly enough.
Right.
And so, you know, we need to be looking at taxation of these very, very wealthy landowners. Mm-hmm. It's something that nobody really wants to talk about, even, you know, at the World Economic Forum. It's hardly ever even mentioned.
Yep.
And yet, of course, it needs to be spoken about. We need to be thinking about paying back damages to those who have suffered most. Yeah. So many of the developing nations that actually incur, you know, so many of the damages and
environmental damages and weather damages. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, so many of these nations that have not caused any of the problems are the ones suffering the most. So thinking about how we can then support them and then sort of shifting our investments back into sustainable practices rather than continuing to support things like fossil fuels and that sort of thing, which still has a huge amount of funding and government investment. So, you know, just rethinking how we're using our money, how we're treating the land, how we're thinking about natural resources, and you know, so turning our worldview to see it as something that we need to be giving back to and supporting and caring for.
Right, rather than taking all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then the second part that you talked about is humble governance. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so humble governance, I think what I mean by saying humble is looking at how we interact with the land from a place of humility and understanding that we are one of many on this planet that need caring for. So that's where the word humble comes from. And actually, Aldo Leopold uses that word quite a lot too, like looking with sort of an intelligent humility at our place on the planet and how we therefore must be responsible stewards.
Yeah, rather than conquerors.
Exactly. Right. Rather than having dominion over nature, that we are there to care for it, you know, and ourselves and all of
nature.
We're
just passing through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, I think many of the world's sort of major conservation organizations have agreed upon a number that is about 50% of the world's land and seas needs to be protected.
Right.
And so this is, you know, this is something to strive for.
What is it? Do you know what is it right now?
What do we have currently?
Yes.
I think it's about 17%.
Right. That's quite a big shift, which is great.
Yeah. So recently, there was a decision to work towards 30% by 2030. Mm-hmm. Now that's wonderful. And that's a very ambitious target. And it would be wonderful if it was achieved. It doesn't look like it will probably happen by 2030, but at least there's, you know, there are steps being taken to work towards that. But yes, it really is an ultimate figure of about 50% that has been agreed upon is required to really turn things around and to undo many, you know, much of the harm that has occurred.
It doesn't mean that the other 50% can do whatever they want.
No, exactly. So along with that, there also needs to be many sort of environmental protective legislation. And then we also need to be looking at supporting indigenous peoples and local communities to be caring for the land. I think it's something like 80% of the world's biodiversity is currently managed by indigenous peoples.
Right.
And I think it's about a third of the world's forests.
Right.
So already they're contributing a huge amount, but they need to be empowered that much more because they are the ones
that have
ensured good care of the land that is in their management. So we need to be learning from them and sort of extending their stewardship yeah. to other places. So that would really help. And then also, finally, I'd just like to mention investing in women. Because especially in developing nations, about 50% of the farmers are women. And they're often the ones, you know, growing and providing food for their families. And yet they are also sort of thwarted in every attempt to do so because they often can't have a bank account, they can't get funding, they can't get loans, they can't have property in their name. You know, it's just almost impossible for these women, and yet somehow they're still providing for their families.
And so still tending and looking after the land that they are actually able to have.
Exactly. Yeah. So if we were, as you know, a world community, a global community, looking after the women of the world too, then there would be so much improvement in terms of hunger and poverty around the world just by that one simple investment of allowing women to tend for the land in the way that they really want to. So so that is huge, and that has to be done sort of at an individual level. But it, of course, it has to come from a government perspective as well.
Yeah. You also talk about landscape-led development. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because that's really interesting. I think you've got a great example of where that's worked. You've got experience of that working really well.
Yeah. So, well, landscape-led development is a phrase that's being used quite often these days in the UK, maybe other places in the world too. And really, it's about working with the land and setting development within a landscape rather than imposing development on a landscape and just sort of expecting the land to then sort of be able to work around and support that development. So it's about starting with the land and understanding all the natural processes, all the natural systems that are in place on that land. So looking at things like the geology, the soils, the hydrology, the plant communities that exist there, the local wildlife, the layers of heritage, and, you know, our own personal stories that exist on a site. And looking at how then that landscape has been shaped over time. And then understanding, okay, well, number one, is this the right place for development at all? And number two, if it is, then how can we most sensitively place that development within this landscape? So though landscape-led development is often spoken about, very rarely does it actually come about in a meaningful way.
Yep.
So it's often just kind of lip service, I would say, these days still.
Yep.
It needs to be much more sort of thoroughly integrated into our whole planning structure.
Yeah.
So looking at coming up with regional landscape strategies.
Not just tiny area by tiny area that are not connected. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes, because right now so much development happens on a plot by plot basis.
Yep.
And nature doesn't care about plots.
Expansive.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, all the systems like water cares about where our plot boundary is. Yeah. Exactly. So we really need to be thinking about how systems, especially at a watershed level, that is very appropriate to be looking at that and how that whole watershed works. So yes, we do have some experience in that, and we're trying to get more and more involved in that kind of work because I do believe it's at a regional scale.
So it's regional, kind of local authority level.
Yes, and sometimes larger.
Yep.
Where we need to set those strategies that can then sort of lead and direct future developments in an area. So, for example, in 2019, we were commissioned by the Association of South Essex Local Authorities.
Right.
It's kind of a mouthful. So it's six local authorities in South Essex, plus Essex County Council,
were
our clients.
Yep.
And, you know, as they're set within the Thames Estuary and the growth region there, and they're facing a huge amount of challenges to do with sea level rising, flooding, massive loss of important nature sites, population expansion, deprived communities, you know, a lack of connectivity into the City of London. So there's so many issues there that they realized themselves that they could not start to tackle these things in isolation. They needed to band together. They needed to look at it collaboratively. And, you know, how wonderful that they did that.
Yeah.
They also realized that the landscape was going to be key in their future growth strategy.
Right.
So along with this landscape infrastructure strategy that they commissioned us to do,
right,
they also had a few other major programs. So housing, transportation, digital connectivity. So they had some other major programs and that we're all working together.
Yeah.
And so in this case, we were able to look across the whole region at 70,000 hectares. But it was so fascinating and so wonderful to see that when you do look at a landscape at that level and you can look at it holistically, then so many opportunities present themselves. And we were able to then look at all the challenges to do with flooding and sort of farmland that wasn't productive and major barriers caused by infrastructure and industry.
You wouldn't get at the plot level.
You would never see that at the plot level. But because we were able to look at it as a region, then all these wonderful opportunities came up and we were able to set a very grand landscape strategy that then also worked to support development within it. And would actually protect development from things like the flooding risks. So, you know, you can only win when you do such a thing.
Think of the landscape first.
Yeah.
So you also talk about investing in green skills and education to deliver better landscape-led outcomes. So who does this well? What do we need to do? How do we measure success? What is it about? Where should we be focusing?
Well, I think... number one, I'd say we really need to be focusing on our children and the next generation. They're our future. And so, unfortunately, the children of today are often completely dislocated from the land, especially in more and more urbanized areas. So integrating green education and skills into our regular curriculum, I think, is essential for children from very early age to understand their connection to the land and the importance and how we might go about caring for it in the future.
So it's second nature. It's part of who they are. It's how they breathe. Yeah,
exactly. And they understand the unity and the interconnectedness of us all. So that, you know, that's from early days. But of course, we can't just rely on our children to then in, you know, when they're grown to take care of things. We need to think about what we can do ourselves right now. So it's also about looking at how we can work within our communities. There's now loads of opportunities to get involved with coming up with neighborhood plans, you know, doing things like stream keepers, taking care of our green streets, community gardens. There's just so many opportunities at a community level. But then even more involving ourselves in a green labor force.
Right.
So not just as landscape architects, but anybody that's involved with the land and involved in sustainability and environment. You know, the world is crying out for that kind of expertise. And there aren't enough people currently. I don't know exactly what that figure is, but we do know that there's a huge need, especially in conservation and management of landscapes.
Right, so just not enough people qualified to do those roles.
That's correct. And at the same time, you know, some of our university programs are closing.
Right.
Which is crazy. So anyway, we really need to be promoting those types of future careers.
Yeah.
For our children, but also for ourselves. Anybody thinking for a career
change?
Yeah. Yes. So these things are essential.
Yeah. And then lastly, that brings us on to Tend Your Plot, which is a lovely title for the fifth part of what you feel is really important that we can do, that we can action.
Yes. Yeah. So I close the book by looking at what each individual can do, because I think sometimes we're just at a loss, you know, and feel that no matter what we do, it really doesn't make a difference.
We're tiny and yeah.
Yeah. But when you think about that, you know, times how many billion people, of course, it makes a massive difference.
Right.
So one of the key things I outline in Tend Your Plot is using your voice as a citizen. You know, we actually do have quite a lot of power in terms of who we elect,
yes.
the kind of people that we're supporting and making sure that the policies that they have in place are what we agree with. So right. use your voice, you know, write to your local politicians, let them know what you care about, sign petitions, join a march.
Right.
You know, there's loads of things that you can do as a responsible citizen. So that's an important thing, keeping yourself educated, finding ways to contribute in your community, looking at how you travel. You know, are you able to cycle or walk? Use public transportation rather than driving. You know,
right.
things like these make a huge difference and also improve your own health and well-being.
Right. The more we use them, the more they have to be supported and invested in
exactly.
and provided for. So the more cyclists there are, the more we're demanding cycle lanes.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, it all just sort of falls into place. And I should also mention, as a very big one, is the whole food production system.
Yeah.
So what we choose to eat has a huge effect on the way that our lands are treated. Agricultural land in the UK covers about 70%. And so if you think about all the practices and the methods that are used for producing our food on 70% of the land, it's incredible what can be achieved by just choosing to eat organic food,
yep.
locally grown food from farmers that haven't used harmful pesticides and fertilizers. You know, so how we choose to eat, you know, what you're buying at your local grocery store, that makes an incredible difference. It's probably the most important thing you could do.
Right. And something we can all do.
Yeah. It's something everyone can do.
Thank you. I would urge everyone to read the book. It's really great to talk to you about it. And I think you've given us a really great overview of the high level principles, but then the five key tactical or practical things that not just landscape architects, but everyone should be doing. And I think, as you say, the point is to get as many individuals, get the mass. This has to be a mass movement. It can't just be pushing governments, basically, because governments will act when we're
exactly.
voting for the right policies
Absolutely.
And demanding the right policies.